Hello, and welcome to The Big Web Show, everything web that matters. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and with me today is the amazing, the incredible Rachel Neighbors. Rachel has been an award-winning cartoonist and graphic novelist who parlayed her storytelling skills into a web design and development career. Among other things, she has worked with Mozilla, she's been an invited expert to the W3C, and she currently works at Microsoft. She also tends the web animation community via the Animation at Work Slack and her web animation newsletter, and the URLs of those will be in the show notes. And she's the author of Animation at Work, a brand new book from A Book Apart with a foreword by Dan Moll. The book came out yesterday. Hello, Rachel.
Hello, Jeffrey. So happy to be here.
Cool. Happy to have you, and congratulations on the launch.
Thank you so much. I'm super excited. Everyone seems to be loving it. It's a concise book, so people have already finished reading it, and yes, mission accomplished.
Yeah, one of the things, when we were starting A Book Apart, one of the things that we like to say is that you'd get on a plane in New York, start reading about a topic, and when you landed in Chicago, you'd know what you needed to know about that topic. I think that very much is true with Animation at Work. What was your motivation for writing? This is your first book, right?
This is my first technical book. I've actually published two graphic novels as a teenager, but teenager and young 20-something. But this is my first technical book, and the pride of my career. What inspired me to make it was that I've been working with web animation for at least 5 years now. And I feel like when I first came into this space, you know, Flash had been cleared out. Nobody was talking about animation. Everyone was talking about the web like it was a series of microfiche documents. And I get that, but the web I was expecting as a little kid was, you know, full of interaction, of, you know, sweeping animated epic stories. It was a much more interactive place. It wasn't essentially a glorified ebook reader. So no offense to my own book, it is an ebook, but I wanted to see the web in motion. So for the past 5 years, I've been working on specs like the Web Animations API, making little courses around CSS animations and transitions. You can find them at my site and at Frontend Masters if you have a subscription, by the way. I'm just putting that out there. But basically digging in and learning all about how animation can improve user experiences on the web. And what I found was quite compelling. So essentially, I just wanted to pass that knowledge on to the next generation of people developing for the web. I mean, I see a lot of folks struggling, like trying to bring animation into their design systems, trying to figure out when and how to use it, when is it too much, when is it too little. And there's some hard science in there, too, that dictates, you know, when it works and when it doesn't. I wanted to pass on this 5 years worth of accumulated knowledge as quickly and easily as possible so that people can get it into their tool chest and work with it responsibly to build a better web for their users.
Do you find that when you're learning something new is kind of the most exciting time to write about it?
I would agree. I totally think that it is, that beginner's mindset is amazing. I remember Rebecca Murphy, who was long ago a great inspiration to me to learn JavaScript. I remember her once saying that she had started tweeting and talking and teaching about it early in her journey, and as she progressed, it became harder for her to break things down to that beginner level and explain them, and that she felt a loss for that. And I gotta agree, being able to come in there and see it with the eyes of a beginner it's magical, and it really does help explain to other people.
Absolutely. I do think the more expert you become, the harder it becomes to talk about your subject matter in a way that normal humans can understand. In fact, when I was getting involved in web standards, one of my joys was I was surrounded by much smarter people than me who had much better ideas than I did, but they were communicating to each other. They were communicating in this sort of, I don't want to say elite, because it's not that they chose to be, but they were in this rarefied air where they understood what they were saying and normal people wouldn't. And I'd be listening going, oh, so it means anyone can use it, or, oh, so that means that there's less work involved in such and such, or whatever it was. I just keep finding these sort of like, duh, things that I think were great and exciting and were the things that would turn people on to what these folks were making, right? And how did you get involved with the W3C? What happened there?
I think Tab Atkins got tired of me showing up on the discussion threads and essentially being like, but animators need this, and this makes more sense if you do it this way. He was like, oh, fine, you think you have all the answers. Well, why don't you come give us some? I was really excited about that. It was an honor.
That's fantastic. What's it like working with these folks?
A lot like how you described. Everyone has been there and knows so much more than I do about so many things. Sometimes I just like water running over my head. But I have to remember that I do come from a community that they really value the input from that community. Not just animations and interaction design, but also web design and developers, period. They really want to know what people want and need, and they want to be building for that future. So having feedback from the community is important to the W3C, even though they're a little difficult to get to.
And you actually, you make stuff, right? You're not, none of this is theory for you. This is all based in practice.
It's true. I've worked on some pretty awesome projects like Salesforce's Lightning Design. I know that's a Lightning Design is the design system that Salesforce has. And you might recall that Gina Bolton led that effort, and she's pretty awesome. But yeah, been in the field, been working with animation for a while now.
How does animation help in libraries like that, in systems like that?
Well, have you ever taken a look, like the difference between using the web on, say, a browser on your desktop versus, say, using an app on your iPad? You ever noticed that the experience on your iPad, it has a lot more animation? Like, you open an app, and there's a zoom, and then there's this loading page, and then it fades away, and then when you tap on something, it will change color. It doesn't just like cut to the next color. It fades, or it moves down to look like it's being depressed. There are a lot of animations that come in a touch environment, especially in iOS, that you can see. And that's because interacting with a touch device requires a greater feedback cycle. It needs to show people a clear link between you did this, now this is happening because you did that. Clear cause and effect, which animation is really good at. Now, when it comes to your desktop...
It's a user experience that has to explain itself as you're in it.
Right. There's no better way to do that than with a visual change.
It's when I started doing web design, it was desktop and everything was new. And it was really, first of all, you were limited in your visual expression, but also everything was so new, you had to explain. And so it was acceptable design to say, there are blue underlined links, you will want to click them. But you had to explain those things, or navigation may be found over here. Use it to find, you know, it was kind of like when you get CD-ROMs, or do you remember Al Gore's book, Al Gore's interactive book about his first big ecology book? They kept having little insets of Al Gore saying, utilize this to do that. And, you know, explaining. it still happens. Like if you read the New Yorker, the digital edition of the New Yorker, there's this front piece where they explain what you're going to experience. So animation, and this is a point you make many times in your book, can ease that cognitive load. Can, instead of explaining, the slight movement of an object under your finger tells you there's something to this. You have an effect here. You can make something happen here.
Yes, I actually like to refer to this as an active skeuomorphism. Skeuomorphism meaning you've seen like the original iPhone came out, and you know iBooks looked like a wooden bookshelf, and each of your books was like a little textbook, and slowly we've been moving people off of that sort of one-to-one, it's like the world in your pocket, and like, no, the digital world is its own thing. You can understand the paradigm on your own. So animation actually is sort of like the active version of that. You're not actually bouncing a ball across the screen, but it's going to give you the effect that you have. This thing that you've deleted didn't actually disappear in a puff of smoke, but we're going to give you that effect to let you know that it's been disappeared. Or you faved this thing, and now we're putting it into your wish list, so we're going to show it flying over into the wish list icon, so you know that's where you can find it again. It didn't disappear. It's still there, clearly showing where things are in time and space.
That's more of this is coming into the desktop now.
It sure is. Especially, I mean, we're seeing this happen more and more in desktop apps as well, especially like with things like Microsoft Surface Line, which, you know, it has a touch interface. So animation is important whenever touch is involved, primarily because touch is less forgiving, or people are rather less forgiving of touch than they are of a mouse interface. We're already trained to wait for something when we click on it, but when you touch something, you expect it to react immediately. Right. And animation can be good at masking those load times. So you're starting to see this showing up on people's websites, because websites are being websites are being accessed via touch devices, and many web apps themselves are trying to compete in that app-like arena, and most apps have really good motion design.
Do you think? Where do you think it's going?
What, animation on the web?
Yeah,
it's going to become expected very soon. There's this model of predictability where, like, when phones first got touchscreens, the iPhone, people thought that was really cool, but you would still buy a candy bar phone and you wouldn't feel like you were missing out. You'd be like, well, I still have this thing. This works. It's not cool, but it works. But then over the years now, nobody would buy a phone that didn't have a touchscreen on it. Nobody would do that. You'd be like, this is a waste of my money. Send it back. So touchscreen started as a quote-unquote delighter, and then it moved over to being expected. And now you can't really impress people with a super awesome touchscreen, but you have to give them a good one or they're going to feel like it's broken, and they're mm-hmm. going to complain. They'll never say, oh, what an amazing touchscreen again, but they will complain if the phone doesn't have a touchscreen. Animation is on track to become that in design. People will be less noticing, oh, wow, that was a cool parallax effect. A lot of people don't even like those.
Right.
But they will be like, oh, this site, it feels so clunky, and like, everything, it just, did I click that link or not? So it's going from delighter to ubiquitous.
How do you know when you've gone too far?
If people are commenting on it. Typically, I mean, I'm very conservative in my animationness, and typically if people are commenting on the animation, if they say, oh, wow, that was really cool, it means it's too much. There's, especially if they encounter that in their workflow, like more than once an hour, it's likely to become something that they won't enjoy and they will complain about. You know, it'll be like, oh my God, I had to see this thing come up for the dozenth time. Clippy from Microsoft Word is actually a really good example of mm-hmm. this. I was absolutely tickled when I first met Clippy, and then within a few hours, I wished him dead.
Parallax is that too. And there's still times I like it, but sometimes it can be crazy. It can be too much. Let's talk about a small organization, a small company, maybe, or a one person. Let's say that you're a freelance web designer developer, or a small team or a small company that doesn't have a big budget for their design. And right now they have, you know, their site's responsive and it's readable, but it just kind of lies there. What are some things that a company like that could do to prioritize and, you know, opportunities to integrate animation into their existing site?
Well, first thing you want to look for is bottlenecks, like where people are going to, those cognitive load bottlenecks, like whenever the page flashes white or information enters or leaves the screen. For instance, tooltips are a good example. Page navigation is another example. These are opportunities for adding animations. Now, you can use CSS animations. Adding an event listener to find out when the thing has been clicked, and then, you know, transition it out and remove the event listener, etc. You can do that. There are also frameworks like Barba.js that you just put it right there in your site's directory, and you can add page transitions to everything. It's lovely because it doesn't require you to say, well, we can't use WordPress anymore because we need those animations. So we're going to gut everything and switch over to React or switch over to Vue. The nice thing about things like Barba.js, which comes from the long line of thinking of PJX, is that you can leave everything, your regular static site, just the way it is, but you can get a dynamic experience out of it.
That's fantastic. That's barbajs.org. Nice. What are some other easy wins, low-hanging fruit like that, either in approach or tools?
That is you are asking me a very big question. Easy wins with animation. Well, it's hard because sometimes what looks like an easy win to one person is more like a decorative animation to another. Like, you know, animating icons, that sounds easy, but do people really get anything out of animated icons? Do they increase the pool of information on the page? Do they add any context? Do they tell users something they wouldn't have known otherwise? Like I said, page transitions and content coming on and off the screen are very easy. There's also they're easy to reach for, not necessarily easy to implement. But there's also things like hover effects. Whenever something is being interacted with, if you can give the user some sort of a response that something is happening, I think the loading spinner is a brilliant example that we're all familiar with of giving users a little feedback about what's going on so they don't get antsy.
Right. If you let someone know something, you haven't seen what you expected yet, but something's coming, they'll wait a while. And if you don't do that, for instance, there are websites that sometimes you click and nothing happens. For whatever reason, a lot of stuff gets loaded in the background before you get to the next page, and it can seem like the site's broken, like the link's broken. Like, oh, maybe that wasn't a link. Anytime you make someone think about, why isn't this working? That's not what I expected. You're taking them out of the experience you're trying to create, the brand experience, the user experience that you're trying to create, and just sending them down a path of, you know, it's like when if an actor's line rings false in a movie, people stop, you know, believing that the Hobbit's going to save the day or whatever, and they start thinking, oh, yeah, that's an actor, and they were paid, and they probably could have used a shave that day or whatever, and just taken right out of the experience. I like Hover. Hover is a sort of a best case model of how to think about animation. When the idea of hover effects, before even in CSS, when you could do stuff in, when you were a kid, sort of dynamic JavaScript, we all went crazy making everything change when you rolled over it for no reason, to teach nothing, but just because you could. And at first, it was to surprise and delight web designers. And then it was hopefully to surprise and delight users. Like, this is an Easter egg. If you mouse over this thing, something cool will happen. But after a while, it became, let's only do this when it serves a purpose. Let's do this when it helps the person understand, when it helps make this experience more intuitive. And that's still today. Like, if I hover over a link and nothing happens on my desktop, I think, oh, something's wrong. So, to your point a little earlier, it'll just be taken for granted soon. In the same way, if an animation helps the user understand, and it's something so subtle that it will soon be taken for granted, that seems like a good space to work in animation, in terms of doing animation to ease cognitive load, doing animation to improve the experience, rather than because you think it's delightful.
Right. So it's funny that you should mention hovering over things and changing all the things on the page. The very first site I ever built, I think it was on GeoCities, I had it so that when you hovered over the navigation, it would show you a different piece of my art in another frame. I was so, so proud of that.
That's cool, though. I mean...
It was very cool. And even, like, my friends were like, that's cool, Rachel.
But, you know, if you go to art... If you go to... let's see. So I do web design, and sometimes a school, art school will, thank you, and an art school will approach you, and you go and look at their current site, and it's just like this mystery navigation experience where there's no navigation and no words, and you're just having this art experience. And it's like, I get this because this was put together by people who go into an art gallery and it's a dark room and there's broken dolls lit. You know what I mean? It's like Art School Confidential. They're where someone's trying to express something irrational using emotion. You're right. And it's hard when you have an art background. In a weird way, it's harder for people sometimes with an art background to get into web design because we sort of want to be, oh, I could be so creative now. And that's good. But ultimately, what you really want to be doing is going, I can make something that works for people. Do you know what I'm saying? There's that sort of...
Yeah. I actually struggle with this. I love making cute demos. Like most of the Web Animations API demos I've done involve Alice in Wonderland. And they're really cute. People love them. It's a great learning tool because it's so much more interesting to do things with Alice in Wonderland than it is to do things with like moving a sidebar or a box across the screen. Who wants to do that? You want to make a little girl tumble down a hill, you know? Like there's so much more fun things that you could be doing. However, in the practical sense, I always find that when I'm working on, you know, we are designing a website, I'm challenged because I want to do the really cool, neat thing. And I have to remind myself, it's like, Rachel, that's the artist in you. If you want to do art, go do art on CodePen or go build an art site. But these are users and they don't need to be subjected to your art in their everyday life.
But when you do an online, like you have online courses that you teach, or web animation essentials. And
yes.
And when a person first gets to one of those, a little cat moves across the screen. You do a lot of stuff with cats, which I am a cat lover, so I love. And that's fun. I do think when you're teaching, I think a little bit of glitz is okay. I think it helps make...
Oh, I agree.
Yeah, I think it... Because we're appealing to like-minded people when we teach. We're appealing to people who want to make stuff. And part of the desire to make stuff is to make cool stuff that we love.
But at a point, you have to acknowledge, you know, like there's a place for cool stuff and then there's a place for practical stuff. And this book tries to focus on the practical side of using animation, which is totally the antithesis to what you see me doing in the wild. But yes, I have used animation practically. Thank you. Sometimes I can control myself.
We're going to talk about that and libraries and getting animation integrated into the whole organization so it's not just one person's responsibility. But first, we have to take a quick commercial break. I want to thank Blue Apron for sponsoring this show. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. They basically send you a box once a week, and in that box is a whole bunch of locally grown stuff and ingredients, really fresh ingredients for really delicious recipes, always changing, never the same twice. Recipes that you can make even if, like me, or you would not consider yourself a cook, you would not consider yourself a skilled kitchen person at all. You basically learn to be a cook, or, you know, when I think about myself, I think I can make omelets and I can make spaghetti. And that's where I drew the line up until I started working with Blue Apron using their stuff. And it's great. It's fresh. It's healthy. The family can participate. My daughter loves to cook with me, which is really fun. It's great to see her developing those skills and getting, you know, taking responsibility for her own cooking. It's a great way to do that. So Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. Their seafood is sourced sustainably under standards developed in partnership with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. Their animal products come from responsibly raised animals, and their produce is sourced from farms that practice regenerative farming. One of the key things that's great about Blue Apron is they ship exactly the amount of food, each ingredient that you need for a recipe, thereby reducing food waste. if you go to the grocery store and get a big, huge bunch of cilantro, probably half of it's going to go to rot, is going to rot in your refrigerator, and then you'll throw it away, which is not good for the earth, and it's not good for your pocketbook and all that stuff. And the beautiful thing is you get just what you need, just, you know, some incredible expensive little spice that you're only going to use once in this ingredient. It doesn't just sit in the back of your shelf in a bottle that you paid too much for and you forget about. It's just, you get just the amount you need to make that dish, and then you're done. Cooking together is a great thing for families. Families that cook together, eat together, talk together, spend more time together. It's a, and that's hard because, well, we're distracted by all these devices and we're busy and all that stuff. And research shows that Blue Apron family cook nearly three times more often than other families. I live in New York, I'm busy. I used to have a lot of food delivered to my house, often slightly greasy. You end up having a healthier meal. It's equally delicious or more delicious. And you spend under $10 per person for a delicious homemade meal. That's pretty amazing. So it's affordable. There's a great variety. They never repeat the same recipe twice. You can customize it based on your preferences. And each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card. The Blue Apron's freshness guarantee promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, or they'll make it right. If you ever got something that looked funky, they would take care of it. And that has never happened to me, anecdotally, in the years that I've been using them, year and a half, something like that. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/bigwebshow. That's free meals and free shipping by going to blueapron.com/bigwebshow. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. blueapron.com/bigwebshow. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. And now we're into a better way to animate. We are back with Rachel Neighbors of rachelneighbors.com and twitter.com/rachelneighbors or @rachelneighbors, and A Book Apart, Animation at Work. Rachel, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Kicking ass, taking names, the usual.
Active skeuomorphism, my new favorite phrase. The thing, the behavior is the skeuomorphism instead of the graphic design.
Exactly, Jeffrey. Recreating the cause and effect, the physics of the real world around us to help people understand their digital interactions better.
A calendar leaf might fly off, but it doesn't have to look like a calendar. It certainly doesn't have to look like a leather-bound calendar with drop shadows. But it works like a calendar, so I get that it's a calendar. What are some examples of little bouncing balls and other things from life that can add spirit to a digital experience?
Actually, if you don't mind, I want to circle back to something you said earlier about the cinema.
Okay, sure.
You were talking about how people in the audience can be thrown off when they see an actor is, you know, delivering his lines, right? And it breaks that illusion of life, which is also the name of a book by some of Disney Studios' most talented animators. But I really like that expression, the illusion of life. Mm-hmm. Now, the interesting thing is, when I'm talking about animation with folks, what I often hear from stakeholders is, well, where are the studies that prove exactly how long the animation should last, or exactly where we should use the animation, or exactly what is, you know, going to trigger someone who has a vestibular disorder? Vestibular disorders, by the way, are people, are folks who have trouble with their vestibular system. Your vestibular system is composed of your vision, your inner ear, all kinds of different things that give you your sense of balance. And some folks, for various different reasons, there's all kinds of different reasons, might be triggered and feel dizzy or worse by looking at a page with, say, parallax. So There are all kinds of issues with animation.
We did an episode on it a while back. Yeah. Super
wonderful.
Important.
And you should check out that episode, yeah.
Totally. Val Head has written an Elista Part article, Designing Safer Web Animation for Motion Sensitivity.
Absolutely, a good place to start.
Yep.
So I get asked these questions, like, where's the science, Rachel? And the funny thing is, the science is kind of hard to come by. I often lamented, well, you know, it's not like people have been, you know, putting folks under fMRI and then running animations past them on screens and, you know, detecting their responses, you know, actually calibrating it. It's really hard to measure the human visual system from the outside. It's really difficult to be able to define durations and things. They're so small, and the human's visual system is all internal. But recently, I stumbled across this wonderful study that came that was done around the cinematic theory, where they did make people watch Red Balloon and measured their brain responses with an fMRI machine, and it was very interesting. And I read through the whole thing because I've always looked very few. Actually, I don't know anybody who is running these kinds of tests on people using, say, a tablet or a desktop computer. It'd be great if we did have access to those kinds of tests, but we don't. So this was the closest thing I could find. And inside it, I found something very interesting. It's such a great, great study. But essentially, they boiled it down and found out that people are essentially creating this model. This is how the theory works from this study. They build a model in their heads of what's happening in the movie. And when, you know, movies use a lot of cuts, the camera will just suddenly be showing you something from a completely different angle. But cinematographers over the years have learned all these little skills and these little cheats to make sure that, you know, people are kept in flow, that they are never bounced out of that illusion of life, that the cognitive load stays low and they stay in the illusion. What these studies found was that cognitive load visibly increased by increased mental activity whenever a cut would happen in the middle of an action to something different, because that was a signal to the brain that the context has changed. The brain would take down that little model it had built and then build a new one up around the new information. So anytime there was a scene cut in the middle of an action, load definitely increased. So now, this is just, remember, I'm speaking from the science side of me here. So what I'm saying is a theory. It's not defined fact. But it did make me think, well, when people are interacting with a website and they click on a link and then the entire page wipes and they see a new one, that's got to be increasing cognitive load, because now they're rebuilding that internal mental model that they have. They've essentially experienced a scene cut. And so, you know, removing and placing an entirely different environment on the screen increases that load. And if you can animate, that's the equivalent of adding a pan in there, or, you know, a fade or something else to decrease that load, so that people are eased into this new situation without having to burn down all the constructs they've put into place before.
That is,
anyway.
Yeah, that is pretty brilliant. I think that makes a lot of sense. If you're going, first, don't smash someone's mental model that you just built up. Don't take them from a child's website to a science website in tone. Right? Avoid abrupt tonal shifts if you can. But if you can't, smooth the transition with an animation, and people will know, oh, whatever's happening, this is supposed to be happening. And yes, something's changing and I have to do more work, but they're easing me into it. I mean, we use easing in and easing out to describe actions in animation. And I think to an extent, that's what animation does for people's psyche as well, based on what you're saying.
That's how it appears to look, at least in my interpretation of the study's finding.
I like that. How else can animation decisions ease cognitive load, or how can animation decisions support brand attributes, which is something we haven't really talked about yet? Should a bank's animation feel different from the animation on a children's workshop?
Oh, definitely. I mean, for instance, a children's workshop might have more fun, bouncy kinds of easings. Things might have a little bit more of a bounce. They might have increased animacy. Animacy meaning how alive something appears to be. That includes motion to attract the attention of the children's eyes. You sometimes gotta increase motion on, like, for instance, if you're supposed to click this button, the button might have a little wobble on it to attract the eyes down, like, "Don't forget to click on me, kids." But on a bank, you don't want to see a wobbly button. Like that would look like cheap, and you'd wonder, is this bank going to fall apart? Is my money really safe here? Is this a clown bank?
Is it a client? Is that my mortgage wobbling?
Right. And additionally, so CSS in your browser, it ships with a default ease in and ease out, which make it feel ease in, it starts slowly and then it speeds up. It's essentially an acceleration, and ease out is deceleration. Something coming, moving from fast to slow. Now, you can use these out of the box, but then everyone's site is going to feel the same. Their animations are going to have the same rate of change. You can use custom cubic beziers to make cubic beziers. There are plenty of tools. There's tools in your browser right now to make your own cubic bezier curves. Firefox and Chrome both ship with cubic bezier editors, so you can edit the rate of change. And you could have a rate of change specific to your institution, to your brand. And you could use that throughout. Save that as a SAS variable and just call that on all of your animations where appropriate. And your site will literally feel different from other sites.
Do you have examples of making things like that? Have you or working, consulting with folks who've done that?
I do. This is the one that's public. I would recommend people go check out Salesforce's Lightning Design System. They have a very good example of, these are the cubic bezier curves that we use, and this is where you apply them.
Lightning Design System. What did you do with this? How were
Now,
you involved in this?
I consulted on the motion portion, but they did some really wonderful things. For instance, the timing scales that they have in their timing properties, that was created by Amy Lee. She is a prototyper at Salesforce. Very talented, awesome lady. Proof that when two disparate fields overlap, genius occurs. She is a musician and she also is a prototyper. So when she was working on figuring out the different timings for all the animations, that is to say, the durations of the animations, she used a t timing scales that she was familiar with from music so that you can orchestrate and choreograph animations so that they may run at different times, but they all end at the same time. It's fascinating work, and it was just amazing to watch that come together.
I would love to see more about that. Is there any doc? Has she written about that, or is there any documentary footage about that? I have a
And
music
that would have been
background.
great.
I have a music background. My mom was a musician. My brother's a great musician. I'd be really fascinated. It seems obvious once you say it that there should be connections between music and animation, just as there are between music and graphic design. Like rhythm is the life force of these things.
Yes, indeed. We can think often of sound as occurring in the same space as animation. For instance, the Doppler effect is an audio rate of change. When something's moving closer to you, it gets high pitch. When it's moving farther away from you, it pitches lower. This is very similar to thinking about how our eyes perceive visual change, something moving closer or farther away. It's all just different ways of perceiving change. One is visual, it relies on photons, and the other is audio, it relies on vibrations in the air.
That is fantastic. Is this Lightning Design System something that only Salesforce uses, or did they make it available for everyone?
They made it available for everyone, but it's very useful specifically if you're building things to work with Salesforce's overall internal. If you're building little apps for integration with Salesforce, it really makes a lot of sense because that way you're on brand, but you're still building your own thing.
Okay, so what do you feel about pattern libraries generally, and how can so much of our work now is about delivering pattern libraries instead of you know, templates and so on. How does animation factor into that kind of work in your experience?
Well, it's funny you should mention pattern libraries. I've been watching Microsoft's new Fluent Design System come together from behind the scenes, and it's amazing to see the kind of work that people put into this and different voices coming together, making sure that every different angle has been considered, every different user has been considered, every different use case has been considered. But I used to be against them generally, like, ugh, Twitter Bootstrap, that's for people who can't design. Mm-hmm. Get a designer, you bum. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I feel like pattern libraries like Twitter Bootstrap, which I don't know if you call that a pattern library, it was more like a boilerplate, but mm-hmm. that enabled developers to quickly prototype things, even if they didn't have a designer, in the same way that some things allow designers to quickly prototype things even if they don't have a developer.
Right. Keynote, for example.
Right. So I can respect that. In the end, though, when you want to build a real project, you want those two to come together and work together. And if you've got to scale that, like you want to build something awesome that future teams can come together and work on, you're going to want a library of some kind, be it a pattern library of, like, typically developers want reusable components, mm-hmm. a pattern library that's got, you know, drag and drop UI elements, you know, style guide that they can just conform to and everything will be great. But what designers are looking for is a set of principles that they can work from long into the future. For instance, what if there's a new kind of device for delivering a new kind of experience? Shouldn't the principles of the design system extend to dictate how you extend the design into that new realm? So you see that designers and developers both care very much about different delivery methods, and they do their best when they come together into one group and meet both of those needs.
Jeremy Keith talks a lot about design principles too, and Ethan Marcotte's latest book was Responsive Design Patterns and Principles, I love that you're making that distinction. I think, in a way, there's get it done now, which is give me some patterns that will allow me to do what I know I need to do. Give me Bootstrap or whatever, because I know
I have... Give me some defaults.
Give me some defaults that are going to work for today's devices. And principles are more like, what should we be thinking about? How can we... Progressive enhancement is a principle. It's a great principle. And it covers you even if some crazy new device comes along. As long as it reads HTML, progressive enhancement has you covered in a way that a pattern library might not. If it's a device that has like 17 surfaces at once that you control with your mind. I'm being a little experimental here, but probably Bootstrap won't cover that use case. Bootstrap is great for all these other use cases, but it probably didn't envision that crazy one. But progressive enhancement might have.
Neither of those will cover voice and tone, which has to be set as well.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when that 17-sided device comes out, is it going to have a friendly voice and tone, or is it going to be cold and mechanical?
Do you find, so when you're doing animation design and animation consulting to work with, you also have to work with the brand folks, right? The brand designers, the graphic designers who implement brand, and with the writers and content strategists who are working on voice and tone. All of this stuff should be working together, right?
Absolutely. In fact, it's like, take it from me in the past, you always want to have marketing on board at the beginning. In fact, that probably should be a post-it that you put somewhere on your desktop or laptop, you know, just always talk to marketing first, because they have a lot of brand guidelines, and typically they really want you to conform to them. They really want to share them too. You just got to get there. And it can be a little difficult if you don't have immediate contact with them. Like, say you're working with a new team or a new client and you're not really sure where marketing is, that should be your first priority, is to go find those people and sit down and have a coffee with them.
I do think a lot of the problems designers have, in my experience, a lot of my problems as a designer have been when I've avoided talking to people who were powerful stakeholders that I just didn't want to bother with. Because forever, like, I'm creative, I don't want to talk to the marketing folks. Not that any mature designer listening to this, but I had that when I was younger. Like, I don't want to deal with those folks. And those, that was not recognizing those people are creative too. They're very right. creative, and they have a, they're just in a different realm of expertise. And when you work with people, so I thought, oh, well, they have five colors. It won't translate because we only have 216 colors. They should just deal with it. No. Have a conversation and say, okay, here's the brand colors. Here's the, again, this is from ancient web history, but here's the 216 colors. What can we do to get closer to the brand colors? How can we translate? The sooner you talk to marketing or whoever is a powerful stakeholder that's in a different area and get their concerns, the better you can integrate them into what you make and the more buy-in you'll have. They don't, and you'll have a better product. You'll have a better product.
Speaking Many of, hands make light work.
Speaking of better products, I need to read about a better product. I need to do one last sponsor thank you. So let me thank the Big Web Show's sponsor, ZipRecruiter. Now, if you are hiring, do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours, which, if you've been trying to fill a job, is remarkable, because I've often gone weeks looking for the right person. There's no juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Now, find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. Right now, Big Web Show listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter absolutely free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/BigWebShow. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BigWebShow. One more time, to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/BigWebShow. And tell them we sent you, or don't tell them we sent you. They'll figure it out. That's ZipRecruiter. We thank them for sponsoring the Big Web Show, and we're back. We are back with Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hello again, Jeffrey.
We've talked the illusion of life, selling animation to stakeholders, thinking about vestibular disorders, developing data to support the use case for animation, animation as a way of easing cognitive load, active skeuomorphism, my new favorite phrase by you. Someone who's thinking about getting the book, what are the three top things they'll get out of this quick read if someone buys your book?
Yeah, they'll find out, like, a really, really, hang on a moment. I should probably think carefully. There's so much I like about this book that picking some is difficult. My favorite chapter, I will say, is the one on patterns and purpose. Mm-hmm. I feel like there are some, it covers the five common animation patterns that I personally have recognized since I started working with animations. And different people have different patterns, but I really feel like breaking it down into these five different commonly used ones will help you think about animation more clearly and earlier on. Where do you need scene transitions? Where do you need user feedback, et cetera? So I feel like that chapter alone is really worth reading. Then there's also basically for designers, how to hand off animations to developers. What content do developers need in order to reproduce an animation? This is a very big problem when you have agencies where the designers work in After Effects and the developers work in the command line.
Right.
That designers might be like, here, I made you this video file, enjoy, and run off for the weekend. And the developers are, you know, stuck trying to puzzle out what cubic Bezier curve right. will represent this rate of change.
Right.
Yes. So that's the second good reason to buy this book, so that you designers and developers can get on the same page and use the same words and the same deliverables to recreate beautiful animations time and time again.
That's super important. It'd be like, it'd be like someone not even sending you a Photoshop comp, but sending you a ping and saying, just match these fonts, and then asking the developer to guess what the fonts are and guess what the line height is. You wouldn't do that. No professional would do that. It's crazy. And yet someone can definitely hand off, you know, a QuickTime video and say, here you go. And yeah, what kind of ease in and ease out are we talking about? But, you know, you're just asking a person to guess. So what are the, what are some best practices that, in terms of working with others, to make sure that the animation that you envision does the job and gets translated accurately? What designers working with developers, what are some best practices for that communication?
Well, especially, like, ideally, like, how this starts is if you've got two very siloed teams, you've got the designers who've created these beautiful, beautiful mock-ups, and they show them to stakeholders, and stakeholders are like, I like that one, I don't like that one, I like that one, etc. If you're lucky, these are also in prototype form, so you've actually been able to test them on users, but most of us do not have the luxury of an entire prototyping department at our beck and call. So usually it comes down to, you know, movies of interactions and stakeholders saying yes and saying no. So then you get the designers like, I'm just going to hand that to the developer. But wait, designer, before you do that, there's this new thing that's coming out where people take the video, but they also have a set of design variables that they send with it. For instance, the duration, the easing curve that was used, etc. These are very good for handing off. It's sort of like an interactive storyboard. So I've seen that. Storyboards themselves are also a really effective way to document decisions, why they were made. The book goes into how to make those. I do feel that long-term documentation of the animations that you do make a part of your overall design is handy, because otherwise you might have, it'd be like if you had a corporate color that you were using for everything, but you never documented it anywhere. You have to explain why this color is the color it is, what the official color is, and where it is appropriate to use it. So that kind of documentation really interlocks nicely with those goals.
And I will say, as a point, people who listen to the show are sick of me making it, but ability to write, to communicate it, I don't mean be, you know, Jane Austen, but write, communicate ideas clearly, so helpful for designers and developers communicating. The ability to say, here's what I did, here's the actual, you know, numeric value or the color value or whatever, but here's also why. Most people, if they have a reason why, then they're much more motivated to execute, right? If it's just do this because I said, who wants to do that? It's like
working. Exactly. And designers, I've worked with designers who are very excited, very passionate. And when you get challenged by a developer or a stakeholder, you know, why should we spend energy on this? You have to have a better response than because it looks better or because it's delightful. Delight is actually a really bad qualifier for doing anything. You need to be able to come fire back with at least two hardcore reasons, at least two. Delight can't be one of them. Right. For instance, well, we need to do that because the animation here shows people that their favorite is now in the favorites bar. They might not realize the favorites bar is there if I didn't animate it in there. Additionally, it also reinforces the overall hierarchy of the page by showing where the thing is coming from and going to. You know, like, you have to be able to verbalize the meanings and the reasons for doing this. And sometimes in the process of verbalizing, you're going to realize, you know what? This wasn't as important as I thought it was, and that's okay.
Or I didn't figure it out, really. And the other thing, as you mentioned, if you can possibly prototype in front of people, because, I mean, I interact with stuff all the time where I get confused and I go, people worked really hard on this and it's beautiful. Their skill is, you know, is obvious, but I checked a minus and it became a check mark and then it became a plus. Does the plus mean I have added and it worked, or does it mean I should go back? Or the plus turns into a minus. Does that mean it's like just an example recently of a site I was trying to understand, and I was like, really smart people worked on this, but they didn't test it on me anyway, because I'm more confused. And this animation's beautiful, and I wish it were clearer.
True story. I've worked on projects like DevTools Challenger, DevToolsChallenger.com. I built that with a great crew over at Firefox to showcase their really cool animation tools in Developer Edition. And I remember there were so many things that it has a lot of animations because it's a challenge. It's a deep sea challenge. And you can find it at DevToolsChallenger.com if you want to take the challenge. But I remember the early editions. We only had 5 weeks to do it, so I was taking my laptop with this thing on it to conferences, and I'd be like, "Hey, you want to come up see this thing I'm working on?" And I would watch the person interacting on the screen, and there were so many times where the animation that I thought looked great and that everyone thought looked great when I showed them a video of it, when I actually saw a person interacting with it, I was like, "Oh no, that's not working. Oh no, that actually they really got stuck on that one. Oh my God." It's important to put these in front of people. Yeah. Just because it looks good to you in a GIF doesn't mean it's going to work right underneath a mouse or a finger.
One of the most humbling but wonderful experiences that you can have as a designer is showing your work to people and then realizing, oh, it doesn't work at all. And when you want to go, no, you want to go into the room. It's like that cliche from movies where the advertisers are testing something on consumers and the consumers are saying it tastes terrible, it's stupid, and the owner of the company says, damn them, and like runs in and starts yelling at the people, don't you people realize what a great product this is? It's like, there's a reason for that. You know, we get so attached to our own stuff, and we make our own silos, emotionally, mentally. We make our own silos. So,
Detaching yourself from the things that you love while it's painful is probably like one of the best things you can learn to do for your career.
And in life, too. I think there's there's an entire Eastern religion about that. The book, but don't detach too quickly from the book you just wrote. Be proud of your achievement. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. Everyone should have it, and you can get it instantly from abookapart.com. The book is Rachel Neighbors, Animation at Work, forward by Dan Maul. The point is, animation is not just decorative. It creates a better web. It's an ebook. You can get it from abookapart.com. And Rachel, I want to thank you for making time to talk today. I want to wish you the best of luck with everything that you're doing. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, Jeffrey. It's been a pleasure.
It really has. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with another Big Web Show. Take care, everybody.
Bye.